Hello, and welcome to COVIDcast, a weekly Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of coronavirus on the world and international life. My name is Roland Raja, and I'm the lead economist and director for international economics at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we are sitting down every week with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. You'll find all the previous episodes on the homepage of our website. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Adam Tooze, who is a professor of history at Columbia University and the director of its European Institute. Adam is best known for his 2018 book, Crashed, which is seen by many, including myself, as one of the best books on the global financial crisis and its aftermath. Today, I'll be talking with Adam about the COVID-19 crisis and how this and other forces are radically altering the nature of the world economy and its future. Adam, thanks for joining me today.
Pleasure to be on.
So let's start with a big picture. You know, broadly, COVID-19 was first a crisis in China, Asia, then in Europe, and then in the United States and globally. And so as it spread from one center of the global economy to the next, in your view, you know, how has the story evolved and where do you think we're up to at this point in the crisis?
Yeah, it really has been a constantly shifting picture. Early on in February, there was still very serious speculation by very serious people that this could be the Chernobyl moment for the CCP regime in China. That now seems quaint, frankly, as a way of thinking about what's happened. China has come back strong, rapidly. Even if you don't trust the numbers exactly, nevertheless, I think there's every reason to believe they've established a grip on the epidemic and have been able to restart their economy. Europe, on the other hand, looked initially as though it was really shaken, profoundly so. The crisis hit the weakest link in the Eurozone. It hit Italy first. The numbers are still terrible. If you compare them with China, the mortality rates in Europe are really bad, and the worst spots of Italy are the worst in the world still down to this day. But the kind of Eurozone and the EU has rallied in a strange kind of way, and we've actually seen a big push to consolidate a new phase in the development of the EU and the Eurozone as a fiscal apparatus. And the United States, on the other hand, has been on a real roller coaster. I mean, there was the complete mess and shambles, really, of the initial response to the epidemic. Then really a rally late March, early April, as the Fed first and then the Fed and Congress together launched a really dramatic response to the crisis in terms of fiscal and monetary policy. And that basically since the end of April has begun to unravel. It unraveled in the Trump presidency itself, which began to lose its grip on the situation. Then bipartisan consensus in Congress broke down on the next phase of stimulus. And of course, now for the last week, we've been seeing the most extraordinary scenes of social and political disorder in the United States that we've seen in decades.
Yeah, that's right. And I should note for listeners, you're, of course, based in New York. And, you know, obviously, there's a lot of turmoil over there right now. A lot of things happening. I mean, what do you sort of make of all this? And in particular, you know, what's the connection, if any, to, you know, the impact of the COVID-19 crisis, in your view? I mean, is there a connection there?
I think there really is. I think it operates at many different levels. There is a sense, I think, in which the COVID crisis has created a kind of collective global awareness of problems. It's difficult for me otherwise to explain the extraordinary scenes of protest and solidarity demonstrations that we've seen around the world in response to what's going on in the United States right now. It is as though we kind of inhabit a kind of global fishbowl in which everything is, as it were, of everyone's concern. It's difficult to imagine either that the extraordinary curfew regime with which American cities have responded to the crisis, were it not for the fact that they were already essentially under lockdown. And on the other hand, of course, it's also true that the African-American population has suffered terribly from COVID-19. They're at the center, really, of a health crisis. But I would be leery about drawing direct connections between the unemployment crisis in the US, which is massive, and the social protests that we've seen. I think it's more that they have a common origin. In other words, the health inequalities that we've seen that are so grievous that have caused the African-American population to be so much more seriously affected by the virus than the white population are of a piece with the routine violence that the black population and especially black men suffer at the hands of the American police force. But it isn't as though, if you like, the virus crisis is exacerbating a social crisis, which then, you know, has unloaded in the streets. I think there is a sense on the part of the American left that they are dealing with, you know, a Trump administration which is essentially on the run and that can be harassed effectively. And on the other hand, I think to understand the disorder that we're seeing in America's cities, we also have to understand, of course, the role of the police. And, you know, it's commonly said, and it's clearly true, that the riot, insofar as there's been a riot, has been on the part of the police a lot of the time. And those do tend to be Trump-supporting, often Republican white men, whose pent-up frustration is venting itself on their opponents as they see them on the street. And the sort of talk that we've heard out of the Trump administration about American cities as a battle zone, that too, I think, can be understood as part of this crisis mentality in which everything about American society, down to the numbers of mortality, down to whether or not you choose to wear a face mask, has become politicized. I mean, to talk about a civil war situation is no doubt exaggerated. But on the other hand, when you see these pictures, and you will have seen them on the internet, of, you know, demonstrators standing opposite each other with one side armed, it's a truly dramatic situation that we're witnessing.
Yeah, it really makes one question their ability to handle, you know, any crisis really at this point in time, but particularly one, you know, as deep like COVID-19. And as you say, at the beginning, there was a much more forceful and bipartisan response. Now that looks to be disintegrating. I mean, what's your outlook in an economic sense where the US might be headed from here?
I mean, it's important, I think, to distinguish the social crisis, which is real and long-lasting, the profound crisis of inequality in American society, the politics of race, which are also profound and long-lasting, and that violence goes on. But precisely because America has become such a polarized and radically unequal society, it's not clear what connection that has to the functioning of American business, to the prosperity of affluent suburban America, to the Dow Jones, the S&P 500 and NASDAQ, all of which have done well this week. You know, there has not been a setback. So there's an extraordinary disjuncture, which is itself linked to the profound inequality. So you could imagine, if you were, a full-on social crisis combined with massive violence, combined with something like a recovery from the COVID-19 crisis. It's difficult to imagine that ever being fully complete, but it's not inconceivable because it's an expression of the polarization of American society. How, whether or not under these circumstances, it's possible to imagine collaboration in Congress around another stimulus program, I think remains to be seen, but that's clearly what's needed at this point. The unemployment crisis is dramatic. It'll be very interesting to see what the unemployment application numbers show up tomorrow morning. Thursday, 8:30 a.m. Eastern time has become, you know, a moment of high drama in the U.S. as these numbers have rolled in. We've topped 40 million applications. There are large parts of the U.S. which have seen a quarter to a third of the working population apply for unemployment insurance. Without another round of stimulus, and especially one directed at propping up the finances of American government, local government, state and city level government, it's very difficult to see how America comes out of this fast.
Maybe we should switch across to Europe, where it's kind of the opposite. It started off extremely negative. Now, particularly as they're announcing plans for an EU COVID recovery fund, it's starting to seem much more positive. How significant is this latest move with the COVID recovery fund? You know, I don't think in terms of its size, it's perhaps not as big as it looks. I mean, 750 billion euros is a lot, but it is spread out over a few years. Conversely, it's not insubstantial either, and it could be scaled up. So perhaps, you know, it's more about symbolism about the EU finally moving forward. I mean, what's your view on things? How does this change the outlook in your take?
I think you're absolutely right to put the point about the scale of the program. It's not massive by the size of what the Americans have done. It's large in international comparison. You know, the Chinese this time around have not blown, you know, things out of the ballpark the way they did in 2008-09. And it's complemented on the European side by very large-scale national programs, which have been dramatic in their scale, and the EU rapidly moved to remove any restrictions on national-level action. The question, of course, going forward is whether those can be made sustainable in terms of the management of debt. And also by very dramatic action by the ECB, again, not on the Fed scale, but certainly enough to stabilize bond markets. But why this package matters is really not so much the numbers. If it had been insubstantial, of course, we could have just dismissed it. It's big enough, however, to qualify as a really serious political gesture. And that's the crucial thing. what they have chosen to do, rather than refight the old battles of 2010 and after, is to say, you know what, this is a different crisis, a novel crisis. And that's one way of using this, is to say, look, it's a new challenge. Therefore, the moral hazard issues that we were so preoccupied with in 2010 are not relevant. The Italians didn't wish this crisis on themselves. And so this is a moment for solidarity. And that's significant because it took them some time to get to that point. There is resistance. And we won't know, you know, the fat lady won't have sung until this deal is actually done. And we are some way away from that yet. Those complicated bargains have to be struck. This is a very complicated package because they decided to run it through the EU's budget. So that creates two types of problems. A, it gives a strong voice to people who might potentially veto. And it creates a very complex bargain, which has to include the East Europeans as well. So this is not a done deal, but the mere fact that Berlin was willing to move, Angela Merkel was willing to move as close to the French as they have is highly significant.
Yeah, I mean, it's also quite interesting because it wasn't that long ago that we had this German Constitutional Court decision going against the bond buying program of the ECB, the European Central Bank. And at that point, it looked very much like Europe might be heading in the opposite direction towards less coordinated action and less solidarity, and certainly away from the direction of a fiscal union that most economists would be saying is the direction they should be headed. What's left of that story and that concern, given that Angela Merkel has moved in the direction that she has?
Oh, that's by no means played out yet. So the ECB's ruling is very complex in legal terms. It concerned not the current pandemic bond buying program, but Draghi's mega QE that he launched in 2015, which was one of the biggest bouts of QE, up there with the Bank of Japan in terms of size. Late compared to the Fed, but massive when it finally came. Highly controversial. And what the court ruled is that the ECB overstepped its bounds. In a sense, it was pursuing economic policy, not monetary policy. It didn't engage in what the court deemed to be adequate judgment of proportionality in so doing. We get into the legal weeds at that point. I think there are two things to be said. First of all, the court's ruling was about monetary policy, about what central banks can do. And one, the most charitable way of reading the court's ruling is that it was asking precisely for a step beyond palming all of this policy work off on the central bank. It was actually asking democratically elected politicians, democratically legitimated politicians, to make choices, to defend them to the electorate, to campaign on them and to build legitimacy for a proper economic, therefore also a fiscal policy for Europe. Now, whether they will accept the particular construction that the French and the Germans have rigged together is a different question. But another way of reading the court's judgment is that they were appealing, as it were, for us to overcome the logjam that required all of the work to be done by the central bank, which is, of course, a common feature of many advanced economies right now. And in that sense, the decision of the Germans to go along with the French in pushing this program is an answer. There is also, I think, a tactical sense in which Angela Merkel, who is, you know, presides over a center-left, center-right coalition as the presiding head of the center-right wing of that coalition, faced with a judgment by the German court, which appealed in a sense to German nationalism and was responding to plaintiffs who come from the far right. One of the people that the court was answering to was a founding member of the AfD, the German right-wing, extreme right-wing party. She was under pressure to come up with a constructive response. Having said all of that, how the Germans will in fact respond to the court's ruling on central bank policy is as yet completely undecided. We have no clear decision on that. What is obvious is that the ECB is going to stonewall. So this was a judgment in which a German Supreme Court was requiring the German government and the German parliament to demand from the ECB a justification for its monetary policies. And the ECB's position is it doesn't answer to national courts and it doesn't answer to national governments. It's in fact explicitly enjoined against doing so, which is what made it a European agency. If it will answer anyone, it will answer to the European court and it will answer to the European parliament, which it does as a matter of routine. So what the ECB has said is this is a problem for the Bundesbank, if it's a problem for anyone, for the legacy German central bank. The legacy German central bank is, of course, the most influential central bank in Europe other than the ECB. And it now finds itself in an incredibly uncomfortable position where it's either a member of the Eurozone system and remains locked within that, or it's a national German institution and is answerable to the German court. And we don't have a solution on this yet, and that will have to be played out in the coming weeks. But the ECB has taken a very clear line. And I think we gather from internal reporting that the French and the Italians just put their foot down and said, look, you know, however tempted you might be, you're in Frankfurt. The ECB sits in Frankfurt. It sits alongside the Bundesbank. However tempted you might be to answer to this German appeal, there is no way that we as a central European institution will do that.
Let's just come back now to China. We're sort of working backwards through the story, back to the US, to Europe, back to where it all began in China. So China, you know, was first into the crisis in many ways. They're the first coming out. That makes them a pillar of relative economic strength in the global economy right now. But at the same time, you know, relations between China and United States, but also the West more generally, seem to be souring in every possible direction, from the COVID crisis itself to what's happening in Hong Kong and human rights issues, particularly with regards to the plight of the Uyghurs. I mean, just at a starting point, I mean, where do you see things headed between the West and China?
I mean, I agree that this is really the issue which over the coming 6 months, I think, is going to displace all others. It couldn't be more important really for the future, not just economically, but also of humanity in general, in light of the central importance of China to any solution to the climate problem. The Chinese economy is indeed coming back. There was an extraordinary moment in April in which, say, the global car companies, VW, for instance, had factories operating and selling cars only in China. So China's significance to global manufacturing has been only reinforced and highlighted by this crisis. They do seem to have got their industrial system back going. It's clear that Chinese consumers are as wary as consumers are around the world in terms of going out, going to restaurants, even going to shops. So there too, the recovery is partial. And as we've seen in just the last week, the Chinese regime is now urgently trying to address the issues, the huge asymmetries within their own economy between, as it were, the big private, highly successful private globalized entities, the state-owned enterprises, and the vast undergrowth of small businesses, the informal sector. You know, they're rolling out a central bank program, which is apparently trying to backstop the microcredit sector so that, you know, mum and pop noodle bars can get support from the People's Bank of China, which is stuff even the Fed hasn't attempted to do, but reflects the fact that China is, after all, in crucial respects, still an emerging market economy. And yet, at the same time, what we're also seeing is that the CCP has clearly decided that now is a moment to push. I think the evidence is they all had already made that decision in the fall and were planning at the twin meetings in the spring to push this through, and those had to be postponed because of COVID. And when they came roaring back, determined to reassert control over the narrative of the crisis, which they have done with real authority and dramatic crackdowns if necessary, and faced with the palpable failure of the West, you know, what's not to like about this situation from their point of view tactically, with the protest movement in Hong Kong disabled by the lockdown there because of the COVID crisis? It's an ideal moment, in a sense, to strike if they're determined to do that. And I think all the evidence suggests that they are, basically. So that then suggests a very bleak future for Western relations. And I think some very hard choices are going to have to be made. And we're seeing those being worked through in various places. It's difficult to know whether one could really talk of a coherent policy process in the United States right now. If there is one, it suggests an increasingly hard line being taken across the board by the security establishment, both by Democrats and Republicans. Australia is obviously pursuing its own course and has a huge, you know, everything to lose in this situation. Europe seems to me to be tacking back and forth in a way that is being characteristic of Europe's approach to China in recent decades, and especially Germany's approach to China has been very complex in this respect. On the one hand, they do emphasize the human rights angle, and on the other hand, they have, you know, next to the Australians as much as any OECD economy has to lose in the connection with China. Mm-hmm. And Angela Merkel, you know, was planning this big summit in Leipzig where the EU leadership was going to meet China. It's easy to underestimate how significant the EU is for China. I mean, it's a long way away, obviously, from the Pacific, but the Chinese understand this is a 450 million population unit. It has one of the largest economic blocks, if not the largest economic block in the world. It has a much more complex trading pattern with China, between China and the EU, than it has with the US, because what does China really buy from the US? It buys tech and it buys raw materials, whereas the trading pattern with Europe is much more complex. And China had designated Europe as its like focus for this year. This was supposed to be the year of Europe for Chinese foreign policy, and all of that has been put on hold and now rendered very complicated. And they've postponed the Leipzig summit. I gather today the official news came through of the postponement. So it's a very, very complex balance that's going to be struck.
Mm. I mean, there's a lot to dig in there, but I do want to draw you on climate change in particular, because I know that's something you've been thinking about a lot. But then again, when it comes to China, this is the one area where, of course, there needs to be cooperation, and cooperation at the same time, as we've just said, is getting much more difficult. So, you know, how are you seeing things in terms of how does the West and how does Europe in particular manage things with China? What's the strategy? What's the approach? Where's the opportunity?
Well, this was supposed to be a pivotal year because we had COP26, you know, the big UN climate conference coming up in Glasgow. A bit embarrassing for the Europeans because it's post-Brexit. So, but nevertheless, there was the idea that following up on the famous Paris meeting of 2015, where we had a big deal, we had the grand deal between the United States under Obama, the EU, with the French leading the way as the local hosts, and then they bound in China and India to the fundamental climate framework, which structures any hope we have of reaching climate stability in the near future. And the idea was all of those pledges were going to be updated and upgraded at Glasgow this year. And with the Americans AWOL and with a substantial coalition of skeptics building around the Americans, which had become clear at COP25 in Madrid, where you saw a whole variety of players, and including, of course, the Australian government, signaling their unwillingness to really ramp up commitments and to go for greater ambition. All of climate hope, as it were, centered on the possibility of a deal, bridging all of the political difference there may be between the EU and China, and that they were going to anchor, as it were, a coalition of ambitious parties. Now, that goes against, you know, in terms of political alignment, in terms of commitment to human rights, all of the issues that you raise, this is a fundamentally difficult bargain to broker. But I think both the Europeans and the Chinese understand that everything hinges on that. And I think that's still true, even if the meeting has been postponed. COP26 will now take place in 21. The summit between the Chinese and the Europeans is postponed. But if you go down into the nitty-gritty, right, the connections are really deep, and especially on the German side. VW is the largest auto producer in the world. One of the hardest nuts to crack in the climate equation is e-mobility. And VW is leading the global push outside China for a new generation of electric vehicles. So they're committed to investing upwards of 60 billion euros. So a really large, this is a one corporation industrial policy that was supposed to drive Europe and drive Germany into the e-mobility future. And that hinges, as VW will tell you completely explicitly, our corporate future hinges on the Chinese market, because the Chinese have led the way in creating a market for electric mobility. And in terms of the future of where they see customers, it's clearly in East Asia and above all in China. And so there's real, down to the level of corporations and technological choices and explicit spending commitments, there is, as it were, the stuff of a European-Chinese bargain. This isn't just, there isn't much, you know, sympathy at a political level, but there is a deep understanding, I think, of the need for a deal. And that's where I think you might see sustained momentum from the German side, because VW is the future of their auto industry and they need a deal to be worked out with the Chinese. It's as significant in its own way as analogous and countervailing pressures, say, from the big oil and gas producers who are tied into China as well. So there's a real struggle, or for that matter, Australia and, you know, your commitment to raw materials. All of the world's major economies are orientating themselves around this. And the Europeans have the most constructive policy of moving towards a green transition and energy transition and see China as a potential partner.
Yeah, well, at least I think that provides us with the kernel of hope in terms of cooperation with China and where things might be going on, one of the biggest issues as well. So that's perhaps something. Look, we're going to have to leave it there, but let me thank you again, Adam, for joining me for today's discussion on the COVID-19 crisis and the changing world economy. COVIDcast is a limited edition weekly podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleague, Jennifer Reinhart, for production assistance. And please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast, and you can stay up to date with all the latest developments on coronavirus via the Lowy Institute's widely read digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and we'll catch up with you again next week.